Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be exploring several major topics today, not the least of which, of course, is health and nutrition, but that's going to come later on in the show. Normally, we start with that, then we go to environmental issues, and from there, our public health issues, then our guest and commentary. We're reversing the order. We're going to have our guest first and then take a look at some of the issues that are not getting attention. For example, yesterday I played a clip from what happened with Emmett Till back in the mid-1950s when he and his cousin went from Chicago down to the South, and just by what was considered inappropriate conversation, simply speaking briefly to a white woman, they took him out that night and killed him. And then the two men who were responsible for the killing were tried, found not guilty in under an hour, and then for a large sum of money, shortly thereafter, told their story about how they did kill him. Now, they couldn't be tried again for that crime. And then I put that in context to the more than 5,000 lynchings and burnings and mutilations of African-American men and women in the past. And then the ghettoization of America, the offshoring of jobs over a 30-year period, starting in the mid-1970s and escalating to where between 2000 and 2014, there were more than 60,000 factories. That's not jobs, that's factories, closed. Most of those were relocated to other countries, India, China, etc. But there was no effort to relocate the people or get them gainful employment who had worked there, many of them their whole lives, or many generations within the same family had worked at one of those factories. And so unless you look at what has happened in the history of a people, then how in the world can you take a single incident and start wrapping around that incident? Well, it's, as Bill O'Reilly does and others on Fox, that it's because they didn't have a mother and father, or there was no discipline. To me, that is extremely short-sighted, and so that's why we're using history as a context to better frame our arguments. Today, I'll continue that, where we're going to take a look at the treatment by the Australian government and the English government of the Aboriginal populations, how they were openly slaughtered, and then how the children were taken away and put into foster care. And that is even being done today as we speak. And there's been no reparations, and it took them over 100 years to apologize, and then there was nothing beyond the apology. They didn't stop the policies. So only when you understand the full history of something can you understand why people may be reacting today. Let me give you just one more example before I go to our guest. We have about 4.5 people per family in the United States, average. So when we have 5.8 million homes that are foreclosed on, you're dealing with about 21 million people who are made homeless. Now, because these people have extended families, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, mothers, and fathers, they do what's called couch surfing, where they move back in there till they can find a place on their own. So the number of people actually on the street is deceiving compared to the number of people who are actually homeless. So we brag about we don't have a large homeless population. One point of fact, we have an awful lot of people who would be on the streets if it weren't for the benevolence of someone that knows them and is a family member. But we do have 1.6 million homeless children who go to school each day. And we have 18 million hungry children. Each day they're food insecure. They don't have enough food for their health. Their families simply don't have the money. We actually have over 3 million people in the United States living on under $2 a day. Historically, we would consider that dire poverty, expecting that from a third world country. But it's here in the United States. So when you look at a country such as Iraq, where you have a much higher extended family, in fact, your extended families in Iraq could go as high as 40 members, aunts, uncles, etc. And in a country of 38 million when we invaded it, you displace 5 million. Over a period of time, you kill over 1 million, and you injure over 4 million. Then that means literally every single person in the country has been affected, or a member of their family has been affected. And yet, not once do you hear a single member of the American media talk about what does it mean to be the victim of an occupying army. Now do the same thing for Afghanistan. And you get an idea that we wouldn't have had 9/11 had we not taken the wrong approach and continued a form of colonialism or imperial overreach without any concern to the shorter long-term impact of these people or their attitudes towards us. So if you don't look at our impacting them, how in the world can you then take a single incident and say, we know why they did it? So we're giving you a larger context. That'll come later on in the program. Let's now say hello from Princeton, New Jersey to Chris Hedges. Now, Chris is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics, social and political activist, and investigative journalist. For more than 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America and the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He reported for the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and other outlets. And while at the Times, he received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. That same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. And he has taught at Columbia, Princeton, New York University, and University of Toronto. He's the author of many best-selling books. Next week, a new one will be released entitled Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, which is a philosophical and historical and timely exploration into the causes and clarion call for a new revolution against a repressive political and corporate state. Chris's weekly column can also be read every Monday at truthdig.com. Nice to have you with us, Chris.
Hey.
Chris, you may have seen the recent Wall Street Journal and NBC News poll several days ago revealing that 96% of Americans believe there will be rising civil unrest in the United States during this summer, and much of this is related to racial or urban violence that is escalating. And it's rather remarkable to get the American citizens to agree on anything. But here is a very revealing example that we're facing a systemic situation and not simply instances that are confined to Ferguson, Baltimore, or recently in Seattle. And we're now seeing incidences of individual street violence across the country. At the same time, never before has there been more unwarranted murders of African Americans by law enforcement officials. We did the research and found that right now, as we speak, someone is being killed by a police officer every 8 hours. Now, why I plan to bring you back to discuss the moral imperative to revolt in greater detail, today I'd like you to focus on the fundamental causes behind this eruption of violent protest and militarized suppression of demonstrations that are erupting as we speak. So please lay out for us what you identify as the fundamental social, economic, and political causes that are sparking the violent protests at this moment and the police retaliation in the future.
Well, thanks, Gary. I mean, I think as you noted at the top of the show, there are long stories that go into creating this kind of anger and rage, justifiable rage. But those stories are not told by a corporate media. This is something that those of us who come out of the Middle East find extremely frustrating concerning the Palestinians, that there is a kind of historical amnesia, much of it perpetuated by the Israeli lobby. And if you don't understand the conditions, that long, slow drip of collective humiliation, despair, poverty, indiscriminate and lethal use of violence by an occupying power and militarized police in our cities have become occupying powers, then when something erupts, as it did in Ferguson or as it did in Baltimore, you can swiftly, as our president did, paint these people as quote-unquote thugs and criminals without grasping that if we were in their position, we would react no differently. And this perpetuates the crisis, because the longer the state continues to murder unarmed citizens, primarily citizens who are poor and of color, without any kind of repercussions, then this will sap the capacity of peaceful protest. Remember that before those that rioting in Baltimore, we had 4 days of peaceful protests. And what most media news outlets never reported, some like the Real News did, was that students, we're talking 14, 15-year-old students, were getting out of schools in Baltimore, and out as soon as they got out the door, when they were released from school in the afternoon, they were being met by police. And because we don't bus children anymore in the city to school, they have to get on city buses. And if they were not immediately getting on a city bus and going home, they were being arrested for loitering or for loitering on, you know, MBTA property kind of stuff. And that there was a kind of provoking of that. And this was the class of the kids who eventually, of course, rioted. And if the state just refuses to respond, and it has, I mean, march after march, even to the point where we now have video evidence of murder committed by police officers, whether it's Earl Garner or anyone else, and the state doesn't have the capacity or the will or the desire to react in a rational way. This is extremely dangerous, and you know, we haven't even begun to speak about the system of mass incarceration, because poor people in this country are not only imprisoned within internal colonies, as Malcolm X and later Martin Luther King called them, but of course they're imprisoned behind walls in cages. And it really comes down to surplus labor, where our manufacturing has fled overseas. Black and brown bodies are worth nothing to corporations on city streets, but they can generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year when they are locked in cages through prison guard companies, private prison contractors who control the commissaries and the laundry services and the phone cards and the transfer money operations and everything else. And of course, within the prison is built on a system of neo-slavery under the 13th Amendment, where you can exploit prisoners for pennies an hour. That most prisoners in the state of New Jersey earn about $28 a month. Commissaries are run by private corporations, and I got a list of commissary prices in 1996. I wrote a column called The Prison State of America that lists all the comparisons. Well, commissary prices have risen by over 100%. Prisoners are not being issued things like shoes that they used to be issued before. They have to buy them. Families used to be able to send them clothing or shoes. That's been banned because now you have to buy it from the corporation. And what we're seeing, especially in states like California, is prison administrators going to these sweatshops and places or corporations that run sweatshops, Target, Pierre Cardin, there's a long list, even Starbucks, Hewlett-Packard, and saying, look, you don't need to manufacture this stuff overseas. We have labor that can never engage in collective bargaining, can never be disruptive, or they go into solitary confinement, who always show up on work on time, who you don't have to pay benefits to, and who you can employ for 20 cents an hour. And so we're watching many of these large corporations come back. And I think the kind of window into the what's happening in the prison system is important because these are the model workers of the corporate state. This is what they would like to replicate throughout the country. Workers utterly stripped of any rights, paid substandard wages so that they are thrown into a form of debt peonage being, as any African-American student of African-American history knows, a very effective form of social control. And so that's kind of the world that we have created. And you're very right that it's because of a corporatized media, because especially on the airwaves, news is judged solely for its entertainment value and its ability to attract advertisers, Unless you live in these sacrifice zones, Joe Sacco and I call them when we wrote our book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which is written out of the poorest pockets of the United States. And I know you did a very fine film on poverty as well. Unless you are physically trapped in those zones, you don't see it because the mass media has rendered, I mean, I would argue at this point, probably up to half of this country invisible unless they are demonized, you know, made fun of on like on Jerry Springer, or you see them on these prison reality, quote-unquote, reality shows where the prisoners are all animals. I've taught in a prison for many years, and every night that I go in and do my two-hour class, we're sitting around discussing James Baldwin, which is also a reality of prison life, but that's not a reality that caters to the demonization of people of color and the poor.
Let's take that a step further, if you would, please. Right now, in 60 municipalities and growing, it is against the law to feed or even house the homeless. This past winter, we had one of the worst Arctic chills ever come through. A lot of people froze to death. But one church in the Midwest, the pastor wanted to bring the poor who were outside on the steps inside, and he was told you can't do that. It's against the law. So on the one hand, we do nothing to stop the foreclosures or the difficulty of people just making ends meet, frequently ending up on public assistance. And by the way, that includes over 100,000 adjunct professors.
Yes.
Largest number
That's right.
in history. And they give them the minimal amount they can and no benefits. Now, for example, in Houston, they passed a law that would fine anyone giving food to more than five people in public. And we saw recently the 9-year-old man arrested for trying to feed some homeless people down in Florida. So the homeless, the poorest, are increasingly being treated like lepers with city ordinances that make helping them punishable with jail time. Churches are even spraying homeless people with freezing cold water when they linger in the alcoves. That's something new that we hadn't heard before. So now we're looking at how can we judge the world as a society when we ourselves are not looking at what we can do for the poorest amongst us, including different religious groups?
Well, we have long judged the rest of the world and ignored our own cruelty and savagery. This country was built on the twin institutions of genocide and slavery. And as William Faulkner understood, this original sin infects the entire nature of empire. I mean, 5% of the Iraqi population, because we invaded a country that had nothing to do with 9/11, did not in any way threaten us. And, of course, under international law, this is a war of aggression. A preemptive war is a war of aggression. It's a criminal enterprise. 5% of that population is dead, coupled with the millions who have been displaced and the destruction of Iraq, where Iraq will never come back as a unified country. So I think for those of us who spent, as long as I did, 2 decades on the outer reaches of empire and understand the cruelty of empire and the violence of empire, the long celebration at the heart of empire of American virtue rings completely false. But what we're seeing, of course, is that the mechanisms of control that are used on the fringes of empire, the violence, the drones, the internal surveillance. I mean, you can't use the word liberty when you are watched, as all of us are, 24 hours a day by those in power. That is the relationship of a master and a slave. All of these mechanisms are rapidly coming to be part of our lives. I mean, a night raid in East New York for a nonviolent drug warrant where they kick down your doors in 2 a.m. and terrorize, including children, everyone inside with long-barreled weapons and black Kevlar uniform plates and is no different from a night raid in Fallujah. And that's how empires die. They destroy their cities. I mean, Manhattan being a kind of island for the thieves on Wall Street and hedge fund managers. But most cities, most American cities, are in terminal decline. And you, as your population becomes more restive, you use the very harsh forms of control that empire has mastered. I mean, we have 60,000 people in the special forces. The special forces function as death squads, as anybody who watched the assassination of Osama bin Laden understands. They do this on a daily basis. So I think for those of us who've covered war and covered the crimes of empire, we know what these people are capable of and will, if they feel threatened, what they will unleash against the rest of us.
Let's speak for a moment about Israel, because the latest report has just come out, and Glenn Greenwald in Intercept had an article entitled Israel's Horrific Brutality and More Criminality in Gaza. I'll just quote the first paragraph. The Israeli group Breaking the Silence issued a report this morning containing testimony from Israeli soldiers about the savagery and criminality committed by the Israeli military during the attack on Gaza last summer. The Independent has a good article describing the report's findings. The Israeli military deliberately pounded civilian areas in the Gaza Strip with fire of inaccurate ordnances and was at best indifferent about casualties among the Palestinian population. Now, this should surprise nobody who paid any attention to the brutal Israeli destruction of Gaza, for that matter. Countless Israeli attacks before that. The UN has said that 7 out of 10 people killed by the Israelis were civilians. That's 1,460 civilians, 495 children, 253 women. And yet, our entire Senate, including Bernie Sanders, who get to in a moment, he's not my favorite person, because of what he has actually voted for. I took the time to get every single thing he's ever voted for. And it would surprise some people, because on some issues, he seems to be very, very much in alignment with proper populist ideals. But then you got to look at where he gets his money. But I'll come back to that. Anyhow, we didn't even have a dissenting vote. They agreed that Israel had the right of self-defense and that Gaza it was going to get what it received. And then the media lined up behind that. And behind all that was AIPAC, the Israeli lobby. And I was just flabbergasted that we couldn't even have one senator stand up and say something was wrong. But there is a senator. I'm going to ask my engineer now. There is a senator who did stand up and told the truth. And I'd like for you to hear what this senator had to say. But this senator is not from the United States. This senator is from Ireland. And we're going to hear something, because if we had anyone like that who had the courage to stand up, that's good. We're going to look at that in a moment. But first, give us your input about our relationship with Israel, Israel's relationship with its neighbors, Israel's relationship with the dissidents in its own community that you never hear about, Israel's relationship with the Palestinians, and how we as a society could give them everything they want, including $3 billion a year military. That's just military aid. That is not other aid. And yet, when was the last time one of our legislators or our corporate media people went into Gaza and spent a week living there to see what it's like? And this isn't something new. This has been going on for decades.
Well, I mean, we live in a system where money has replaced the vote. So AIPAC gives money, and everybody stands up like an AIPAC wind-up doll at a time when one of the most sophisticated militaries in the world is attacking a defenseless, largely defenseless population that has no army, no navy, no command and control, no mechanized units, no artillery, with the most sophisticated weapons of industrial warfare, including attack jets, and calling it a war. It's not a war, it's murder. And that vote, I think, was a window into, I mean, it was like the old Soviet Union. It was, you're right, not even one form of dissent. And you bring up Bernie Sanders. Sanders is awful on Israel, and he's not very good on empire and war. But the big problem with Bernie Sanders is that he decided to run as a Democrat. And So he will not criticize the Democratic Party, as it should be criticized. There is no way to vote against the interests of Citibank or ExxonMobil or Goldman Sachs in this political system. And he legitimizes the party, which is awash in corporate money and beholden to corporate power. And in the end, he will have to endorse Hillary Clinton. And I think he did it for very selfish reasons, which is that he knew if he ran as an independent, the Democratic Party would punish him. He would lose his committee chairmanships. They might even force him out in an election in Vermont. And so I think he's played a very cynical game, and that he raises important issues, many important issues. But at the same time, he is giving legitimacy to a party that, as we have seen with 8 years of Barack Obama, has no intention of seriously addressing the very real and important injustices and grievances that afflict the citizenry. And so Clinton, I think, ultimately benefits from a Sanders candidacy. At this point, we have to, like Syriza, like Podemos in Spain, we have to build radical movements that have a political expression, but that name the corporate state for what it is and call for its destruction. And we don't have much time left. Climate change is accelerating at a pace. Every new report that comes out that is far more frightening and far greater than climate scientists had previously thought. The longer we keep playing this game, the longer we keep funneling energy into a dead system, which is, I think, ultimately what the Sanders campaign is about, the more perilous becomes, finally, the survival of the human species itself.
Let me share some thoughts about Bernie Sanders. This is actual research of his voting record. First of all, he voted Democratic 98% of the time. There are 38 more progressive congressional legislators than Bernie. When running as an independent in Vermont for the same position, he cut a deal with the Democrats that they would not run a candidate. Now, Hillary Clinton's Hill PAC, which is Hillary's Political Action Council, funded him. And he has consistently supported all Democrats, refused to support any third-party candidates. He opposed Nader. He opposed the Green Party. He opposed Vermont's own Progressive Party in past elections. He supported John Kerry. He agitated against Nader. He voted in favor of Clinton's 1999 cause of all war, and when his own constituency went to his office, he threatened to have them arrested. In fact, he did have them arrested. And he didn't join Barbara Lee to vote against giving Bush a blank war check. He consistently voted in favor of appropriations bill for Iraq and Afghanistan. He opposed the withdrawal from Iraq. He opposed his own state's resolutions to impeach Bush 2006. He consistently supported Israel. He voted in favor of Resolution 921, giving full support to Israel to launch war on Lebanon. He voted in favor of H.R. 4681 to levy sanctions on Palestinians, and yet he never was in a Palestinian home in the occupied territory so he could see what it would like to be them. His staff is in alignment with AIPAC. He voted in favor of Iran Freedom Support Act to levy sanctions on Iran. And he voted in favor of Clinton's Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which laid the foundations for Bush's War on Terror. He is a protectionist, and he is also the number one supporter of the Texas, Vermont, and Maine Nuclear Waste Compact that would allow Vermont to dump its nuclear waste at the Texas-Mexico border. And, of course, he is the biggest beneficiary of the $1.3 trillion total fiasco of this bomber. And so those are just some of the things. So I agree, he's going to get into the race. He'll be there. He'll raise the issues. And then he'll withdraw, and he'll support Clinton, and that will give Clinton the swing progressive votes who don't do their homework. Now, as far as Clinton, here's what we have discovered. This is as of today. Here's the Clinton Foundation's top donors who also lobbied her State Department. the Microsoft and the Gates Foundation, between 26 million up. Walmart, where she was on the board, between 2.5 and 10 million. Coca-Cola, these are all multi-million dollar donations. The state of Qatar, Goldman Sachs, Dow Chemical, Pfizer, Duke Energy, ExxonMobil, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. By the way, that's astroturfing. That's really about GMOs and controlling the land and the seed. Hewlett-Packard, NRG Energy, Procter & Gamble, Boeing, Nike, Google, Daimler, Monsanto, where she also was a lawyer, Chevron, General Electric, Morgan Stanley, Intel, Noble Energy, Sony, AstraZeneca, Bloomberg, Verizon, Yahoo, Lockheed Martin, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Applied Materials, and Time Warner, and Santa Fe, Pepsi, Johnson and Hess Corporation, and General Motors. These are the big people. So why would they be giving the Clinton Foundation millions upon millions of dollars, total hundreds of millions, unless they knew that they were going to be supported on major legislation by her? Could you address these two?
Well, that is exactly the evidence she is going to spend $2.5 billion trying to hide. And she is going to try and sell you the lie her husband sold you, where she talks in that kind of feel-your-pain language of traditional liberalism, even progressivism, while she assiduously serves, as Bill Clinton did, corporate interests. Clinton giving us NAFTA, Clinton destroying the assistance program for children under welfare. 70% of those recipients were kids. The omnibus crime bill that exploded the prison population, the three strikes out law, the deregulation of the FCC, all of that came out of Clinton. I mean, Clinton just utterly sold out working men and women in this country, with, of course, ending with the destruction of Glass-Steagall. And he got corporate money. I mean, by the 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans. And when Obama ran in 2008, he actually got more corporate money than McCain. And so, you know, this is it. This is it. They invest so much in these political, this political theater, and of course run their campaigns largely based on fear of the other. If it's right wing, it's the fear of, you know, I don't know, liberals and homosexuals and people who don't are secular humanists or whatever. And then if it's the Democratic Party, it's fear of the yahoos on the Christian right. I mean, I do have to say that Clinton had a kind of diabolical brilliance in that he turned the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. The Democratic Party in Europe would be, of course, a far-right party. And that pushed the Republican Party into kind of going insane, which is what's happened, and how you cough up these figures like Mike Huckabee and all sorts of these other very stunted and deformed individuals. But I think, you know, the kind of list of donors that you read to the Clinton Foundation exposes it. And by the way, as I was listening to that list, a lot of those companies use prison labor, including Hewlett-Packard, Procter & Gamble, and others. They're deep into the prison system, you know, making imprisoned people in this country work for 20 cents an hour so they can sell us their products. So, I think there's the evidence is laid there. The voting record is important, and it was good that you went and got that. Dennis Kucinich gave me Obama's voting record during the primaries and said, you better read this. And it was worse than Bernie's. It was one corporate giveaway after another. It was kind of a message to corporate America that he was on their side. Because it matters what these people do, not what they say. And if we haven't learned that from the Clintons, then we've learned nothing.
We found a clip of David Norris speaking before his full parliament in Ireland, where we didn't have a single person had the courage to say what he said. And truth is on his side. Let's hear what he had to say.
People are ask, what for? What can Shannon Aaron do? Well, the answer is, in the international context, nothing. You know, nobody will pay that much attention to what Ireland does. But the only reason I looked for a recall of the Senate was because I remember being in Palestine some years ago in an area that was heavily controlled by the Israelis, and I said to my Palestinian hosts, you know, there's nothing I can do. You know, I will have no effect. And they said, but at least you will be a witness. You will be a record to our suffering, and we will not go unnoticed. And it's for that reason that I called for the recall of the Shannon. I'm very sad. I mean, I'm not anti-Israeli. I'm not anti-Semitic. I supported the state of Israel. But in the 40 years I've known the state of Israel and sometimes had a home there, I've seen it completely change. It changed from a left-wing, socially directed country to an extreme right-wing regime that is behaving in the most criminal fashion and defying the world and unscrupulously using the Holocaust to justify what they're doing. And it's time that rag was torn away from them. Israel is afraid of Palestinian unity. That's what all this is about. It has nothing to do with the murder, which is appalling, of those three Israeli kids. It's nothing to do with it. The Israeli police knew that Hamas had nothing to do with it before this war started. And with regard to Hamas, Israel created Hamas in order to split Fatah. And so they're responsible for Fatah. And I had that confirmed at the highest level in the foreign ministry in Jerusalem some years ago. And I have to say, it is astonishing to me that the West prates about democracy. Every time an Islamic government crops up around the Mediterranean, they refuse to deal with it. They subvert it. They destroy it. Where's the democracy in that? We may not like it. You know, they may be antagonistic, and my Jewish friends or my pro-Israeli friends say to me sometimes, how would you fare as a gay man in any of these? Oh, I know exactly how I'd fare, but it doesn't mean that it is correct to deny people the right to choose their own government. What self-respecting or sane people would allow their enemies to choose their government for them? Can you imagine it happening in this country? I certainly cannot. And America has a shameful role to play in this. Israel could not get away with these disgraceful acts of international piracy and brigandage if it wasn't for the protecting shadow of the United States of America. And I condemn President Obama for his utter inaction. And I have to say, I was taken a bit aback when I saw they'd added in Ukraine, which is irrelevant. It's a bit of whataboutery. What about Syria? What about the Congo? What about Iraq? What about everything? Well, we should focus on this. The one thing it does, Minister, is it shows the extraordinary discrepancy. At the instructions of the Americans, we're prepared to boycott, to go in after the Russian banks, to do this, that, and the other. And what do we do about Israel? We don't even mark a protest note with our vote in the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations. I think that's shameful, absolutely shameful. And as I interjected, it'd be better to be one country in the right than with all the rest of them in the wrong. There are no words to describe what happened yesterday in Jabalia. Six attacks on schools, and these are deliberate, I have no doubt. Because you had 3,300 people sheltering there. They'd been directed there by Israel. The coordinates were given 17 times. How could anybody claim that they didn't know what they were doing? Israel's policy is shoot first and weep afterwards. Oh, did we hit children? What a terrible tragedy. Nobody believes you anymore. You're doing this to exert pressure on Hamas. But I tell you this, you will not resolve this problem until, as we did in this country, you involve both of the participants. There's no point in having any kind of an alleged truce that only has one side in it. It was laughable, the rubbish produced by the Israelis, the Americans and the Egyptians. They didn't consult Hamas. I mean, that is just utter, absolute madness. And Tony Blair was involved in it. My God, that man is shameless, utterly shameless. He should keep his face out of the Middle East after what he and George Bush on the other side, done. Yes, there were three mothballed schools used to store weapons. But this was discovered by the UN and reported by the UN, not by the Israelis. Then there was a situation where entire families are obliterated. In one case, 20 members of one family slaughtered. And the children, the disproportionate amount of women and children killed in this situation is a violation of all the spiritual beauty that Judaism stands for. The respect for life, the fact that if you save one life, you've saved the universe. All this blown out of the window. And blown out of the window, as I saw, by the arrival of 1,200,000 extremely right-wing former citizens of the Soviet Union. And can I just say this? I think it's time people told the truth about what people are saying in Israel. For example, Interior Minister Edi Yishan in 2012 saying they're going to send the Gaza back to the Middle Ages. Defense Minister Matan Vilnai said they were going to visit the Holocaust on the Palestinians. That's Nazi talk. I'm not saying that that man's a Nazi. He's describing himself as a Nazi. What to do? First of all, remove the embargo. That has to be done. Then, the Euromed agreement. I mean, there are human rights protocols attached to this. Time after time in the Foreign Affairs Committee, I've asked for this to be monitored. They won't even monitor the human rights.
That's David Norris speaking up within the Irish Parliament. Your thoughts on that, and yet not a word in condemning or challenging Israel in all of its actions, in all this period of time, against the Palestinians?
Well, I had not heard that, and it was wonderful and true and courageous. And the fact that they have so effectively shut out any voice that would speak that truth within the political system is evidence that our political system is dead. And it's not just about Israel. It's about corporate power. It's about the evisceration of our constitutional rights. It's about wholesale surveillance. I mean, we have seen the courts seized by right-wing elements, and they have taken away our most cherished constitutional protections by judicial fiat. So they refuse to rule on wholesale surveillance, even though it's unconstitutional. They refuse to deal with the authorization of the use of the military to carry out extraordinary rendition on American city streets through Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. They twist constitutional rights so that unlimited campaign funds become, by corporations, become the right to petition the government or free speech. It's insane. And the level of compliance on the part of these political elites, who all know that they will soon be millionaires. The Obamas, like the Clintons, when they leave White House, will become multimillionaires. You walk out of the House of Representatives, you become a lobbyist, or you cycle in and out the way Liz Fowler did when she wrote this appalling Obamacare bill, which is the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry. It's just rot. The entire system is rotten from top to bottom. And that's why the forces of propaganda are so intense and become more pervasive and more draconian in terms of shutting out dissident voices, because I think there's fear in the centers of power that this corruption and this coup d'etat that the corporate state has carried out is becoming known. And the more that there is a kind of understanding within the body, the body politic of what's been done, the more we are going to see harsher and harsher forms of control employed as this tiny corporate oligarchic elite bleeds us and the earth dry.
What about the responsibility for those institutions that historically had stood for some barrier between the population being completely exploited and those exploiting, like Mother Jones or The Nation magazine or MSNBC? Because when I look at them now, I'm extremely disappointed of how they have been compromised in many measure.
Well, let's look at MSNBC. I mean, MSNBC is just a propaganda arm of the Democratic Party. When was the last time you ever heard any criticism of Barack Obama on MSNBC.
You don't.
Of course, they've, you know, Michael Eric Dyson and Al Sharpton and all these people have made it a kind of personal crusade to destroy the prophetic voice of Cornel West because he speaks the truth. And by speaking the truth, he exposes them for who they are, which are sellouts to corporate power, as Barack Obama is. And so, you know, the evisceration of traditional liberal institutions, and we can go into the academy and labor, the Democratic Party, the liberal church, which I come out of, the arts community, which has been destroyed and commercialized. And that's the theme of my book, Death of the Liberal Class. That's what I talk about, the death of liberal institutions, which traditionally function in a capitalist, a democratic capitalist society as a kind of safety valve to ameliorate the suffering and grievances of the citizenry to perpetuate the system. That's what Roosevelt did with the New Deal, and Roosevelt says that his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. Well, they broke that system. And because they broke it, what they're going to get is upheaval eventually. Because
how do you see that? How do you see that
citizenry to appeal to power?
Chris, how do you see the upheaval coming? If you were to look forward and give us your best guesstimate over the next 5 years, based upon the perfect storm of companies closing in record numbers, and we're not told about these companies closing. Mm-hmm. But they are, and we're told that the economy is rebounding. It's not. Let me give an example real quick. We now have at least 6,000 stores that have employed a lot of people who are closing. 180 Abercrombie & Fitch, 75 Aerosale. We have 150 American Eagle Outfitters, 223 Barnes & Nobles, 265 Body Central Body Shops, and then it goes down from Bottom Dollar to Build-A-Bear to Chico's and Children's Place. And each one of these is closing, and we have 6,000 of these, and I have them all on a list right in front of me of these. So that means jobs. The trouble is these people will not be able to easily go out and find another job. Many of them have worked there for a long time, some for their whole careers. They're going to be out. And no one discusses this. This is not discussed anywhere as what do we do with all these people who are going to be unemployed. So we have that coming. We have global warming causing incredible havoc within the environment. 20 states are now in permanent drought, and California is not actually the worst. It's the largest, and therefore it's the most focused upon. But you have Nevada that gets all of its water from Lake Mead, and Lake Mead is within 5 feet of being declared a national federal emergency where they have to ration water in Las Vegas. You have 40 million people get their water out of Lake Mead, and that's going to be substantially cut because there's not enough water. So we have disaster after disaster. We're doing nothing about it. We have economic problems. We're doing nothing about it. And then we have social issues where people are simply working two or three jobs. They're exhausted. And instead of trying to understand what it means to be these people and to help them at any functional and meaningful level, we simply now penalize them. You can go to debtors' prisons. 27 states now have debtors' prisons, and we now have a private judging system and truancy system. And you have to go and pay to have a truant officer read your case. There's a woman who had a $40 ticket, a parking ticket. She ended up paying over $500 and still owes $40 because it was turned over to one of these private systems, these private contractors who handle all that now for cities to get the city's money. Could you address the likely scenario since all this is happening?
That's a very important point because we see it within the prison system, that the corporate state preys on the most vulnerable. So you have in St. Louis County, where Ferguson is, municipalities or city governments like Ferguson that depend on fines for 30 to 40% of their revenue. So you're fined if you don't cut your grass. You're fined, we saw with the case of the guy who got stopped for the taillight and ran and got shot. I mean, they just grab you and fine you for anything. And then when you can't pay your fines, that's compounded. You're often thrown in jail. And it's kind of futile, or it's kind of back to, you know, the oppressive systems that were put in place by, like, dying regimes like Louis XVI in France, where you exploit those who are on the lowest end of the economic spectrum with kind of unchecked abandon. And that's what's, I think, fueling much of what we're seeing in places like Ferguson and Baltimore. Within the prison system, it's appalling, where, you know, you want to send money to a prisoner's commissary account. You have to do it through JPay, which is a private company. You send $20, they charge you a $4.95 commission fee. The same is true with the privatized phone system. They force you to buy the most basic products now. I mean, like, you used to get in the New Jersey system two blankets, you get one. You don't get thermals anymore. And these are all companies that are making money. So it's aside from the slavery, over a million people now working inside prisons, most of them for large corporations. And the families are just being broken. So I think that's often, it's a very important point that you raise, and it's often one that's not seen by the outside, the extent to which these corporate forces are, in essence, carrying out systems of robbery of the poorest of the poor. And that is an important element in cities like Baltimore. It's an important element in cities like Ferguson, because they're just, they can't make it. There's nothing left. And that is what corporate capitalism does. It has no self-imposed limits. It now has no external limits. It exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And in that sense, we have to go back to Karl Marx, that built within the nature of unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a self-annihilistic quality, because ultimately the system that it seeks to create, I mean, a consumer society needs consumers, but consumers without money can't consume. It destroys itself, and it will finally destroy the planet. And that's why we have to destroy it first.
Thank you very much, Chris, for being on and sharing your insights on this. It's very important. Chris's new book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Chris, I look forward to another conversation where we'll go into depth on the future of these revolts and what they're going to look like and how you believe they should be used to reconstruct, reconfigure the social dynamic. Appreciate it.
I look forward to it, Gary. Thank you for doing this.
Chris Hedges, continuation of our conversation through Remarkable Minds. We're going to end the show today with a statement by Claire Daly from the Irish Parliament.
Taoiseach, I think it's important to take this opportunity to bring a bit of balance into the discussions around the visit of the US President and his wife, given the almost unprecedented slobbering over them that the nation has been exposed to over the last number of days. And it's really hard to know which is worse, whether it's the outpourings of the Obamas themselves or the sycophantic fawning over them by sections of the media and the political establishment. We've had separate and special news bulletins by the state broadcaster to tell us what Michelle Obama and her daughters had for lunch in Dublin, but very little questioning of the fact that she was having lunch with Mr. Tax Exile himself. We had very little challenging of the fact that she's glad to be home. Home, a country that she's been in less than a week and that her husband has very tenuous links in. And of course, the biggest irony of all, the protestations of Obama himself in his speech to the children in Northern Ireland about peace. When he said, those who choose a path of peace, I promise you that the United States of America will support you every step of the way. We will be the wind at your back. Now I ask you, is this person going for the Hypocrite of the Century Award? Because we have to call things by their right names. And the reality is that by any serious examination, this man is a war criminal. He has just announced his decision to supply arms to the Syrian opposition, including the jihadists, fueling the destabilisation of that region and continuing to undermine secularism and knock back conditions for women. This is the man who is in in essence stalling the Geneva peace talks by trying to broker enhanced leverage for the Syrian opposition by giving them arms, and to hell with the thousands more who lose their lives or the tens of thousands more who will be displaced as this war goes on. This is the man who has facilitated a 200% increase in the use of drones, which have killed thousands of people, including hundreds of children. And you, Taoiseach, you are the one who's turned a blind eye on these activities. You've talked about the G8 being an opportunity to showcase Ireland. But is it not a reality that you have showcased us as a nation of pimps, prostituting ourselves in return for a pat on the head? To be honest with you, we were really speculating this morning whether you were going to deck the cabinet out in leprechaun hats decorated with a bit of stars and stripes to really mark abject humiliation here. So my question to you, Taoiseach, is as follows. What steps are you going to take to follow in the correct statements and the correct decision of your colleague Taoiseach Eamon Gilmore, who voted against the lifting of the arms embargo in relation to Syria? What steps are you going to take to ensure that no weapons for Syria are going to go through Shannon in breach of our international laws on neutrality? What steps are you going to take to showcase this country, not as a lapdog of US imperialism, but as an independent nation with an independent foreign policy, which takes a lead in international diplomacy to outlaw the use of drones, the favourite method of extermination of your friend, Mr. Obama?
Okay, that was Claire Daly. Boy, if we only had one of her in our entire government, what a difference it would make. Refreshing to hear people can tell the truth. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's show. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to you, Luann. Hi, Luann. Is Luann there? No? Okay, let's say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Today we get an update from Detroit, where the Detroiters slammed a tax move by the government yesterday. And we're also talking about the need for police reforms. Who is putting together these reforms?
The police. Boy, that'll be objective, won't it? We promise to be better in the future.
More efficient at killing you.
Yeah. Yes. You trees lead right now.